Hello, this is your sunshine, the Arizona Volunteer Leader, Joy Marini, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, February 17th, 2026. And here are today's news briefs. Judge ordered restoration of Washington's slavery exhibit. The National Park Service must restore the exhibit at the site of George Washington's residence in Philadelphia, after it was removed late last month. Judge Cynthia Roof, who was appointed by George W. Bush, said the exhibit detailing the lives of 9 people enslaved by the first president must return to Independence Mall. Its removal followed a Trump executive order directing national parks and cultural sites to avoid content seen as casting the nation or its historical figures in a negative light. 11:36 a.m. ET staff. Russia and Ukraine continued peace talks. Officials met in Geneva on Tuesday for another round of U.S.-backed talks. Core disputes over territory and security guarantees remain unresolved, with Russia occupying around 1/5 of Ukraine's territory. The diplomatic push comes amid continued attacks, with Russian strikes hitting 12 regions just hours ahead of the meeting. Last month's talks in Abu Dhabi were the first trilateral talks since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. 11:23 a.m. ET staff. Marco Rubio reassured European leaders in Munich. At Saturday's security conference, the Secretary of State said Washington is not abandoning the transatlantic alliance. Emphasizing shared history and culture, he said, "Our destiny is and always will be intertwined with yours." While reiterating concerns about immigration, deindustrialization, and military strength, the remarks came as a relief to many and earned a standing ovation a year after Vice President J.D. Vance's sharper rhetoric fueled fears of a transatlantic rupture. 7:13 a.m. ET staff. Iran and U.S. talks about nuclear program underway. The second round of talks on Tuesday in Geneva comes a day after Iran held naval drills in the Strait of Hormuz, a key oil shipping lane. President Donald Trump said he would be involved indirectly. A first round of talks took place earlier this month in Oman. Negotiations last year failed to produce an agreement that would have lifted U.S. sanctions in exchange for Iran curbing its nuclear program. Iran's top diplomat met yesterday with the head of the United Nations nuclear watchdog. 7:03 a.m. ET staff. Giselle Pellicott released memoir, A Hymn to Life. The French woman recounts for the first time surviving years of sexual assault at the hands of her ex-husband and dozens of men he invited into their home. Ms. Pellicott has been hailed as an icon in the fight against abuse after waiving her right to anonymity in last year's trial. "Within us, we have resources that we don't even suspect," she said to the BBC. 6:34 a.m. ET staff. Jesse Jackson spent a lifetime fighting for equality. He will be remembered by many for what his family called an unwavering belief in justice. The civil rights leader, who was once close to Martin Luther King Jr., spent decades fighting for the disinherited, the disrespected, and the despised. As he said in 1984 in a speech, that year he became the second black person to run a nationwide campaign to become president. In a statement announcing his death on Tuesday, his family asked for all to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by. 6:02 a.m. ET, staff. Our first article from the Middle East. In Gaza, Israel's creeping yellow line takes Palestinians' land and lives. By Ghada Abulfata, special contributor, and Taylor Luck, special correspondents. February 17th, Gaza City, Gaza Strip, and Amman, Jordan. For Palestinian residents of Gaza, a string of concrete yellow boxes now demarcates where Israeli-occupied land begins, a barely visible border that for Palestinians who cross it marks the line between life and death. It also marks a shrinking amount of space in which displaced Gazans can live. The blocks, some with yellow poles, mark the so-called yellow line, which residents say is steadily being moved further west and south by Israeli forces. A temporary makeshift armistice line, the yellow line, was to disappear and Israeli forces were to withdraw from Gaza as the Trump peace plan progressed. Yet the peace plan is struggling. As part of the initial phase of the Hamas-Israel ceasefire, brokered by Qatar, Egypt, Turkey, and the United States, the Israeli army withdrew in October from deep within the Gaza Strip, back to a perimeter well within the territory, carving out a temporary buffer zone within only about 50% of the enclave. Yet Hamas refuses to disarm. An international stabilization force has not materialized, and Israel refuses to leave. In this temporary zone, Gazans fear, might be becoming permanent. They put down the line, and every period they push it further, says Mohammed Abu Sahil, a lawyer whose home in Beit Anun in northern Gaza now lies under Israeli military control and out of reach. They're squeezing us, says Mr. Abu Sahil, who lives in a displacement camp in central Gaza. It's not only the geography that shrinks, displaced Gazans say, but choices. Fewer safe roads, fewer possible livelihoods, fewer schools, less water, and less certainty. The yellow line prevents tens of thousands of Gazans from returning to their homes in Rafah and eastern Khan Yunis governorate in the south, in the eastern Gaza City and the towns of Beit Lahaya and Beit Hanan in the north. Israel says its ongoing occupation up to the line is part of its dismantling of Hamas's infrastructure. While visiting Israeli-held territory last week, the Israel Defense Forces Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Ayel Zamir, said the Israeli military was overseeing the crossings to the Gaza Strip and is precisely dismantling terror infrastructure, particularly Hamas dug tunnels. Yet General Zamir has also described the zone as a new borderline, a former defensive line for the Israeli communities and an offensive line. Israel says it has destroyed several tunnels using Israeli forces and Israel-backed Gazan militias and has confiscated weapons stockpiles and equipment. Its operations have erased entire neighborhoods, satellite imagery reveals. The Israeli army is also killing Palestinians attempting to cross the line on a near daily basis, alleging the individuals are Hamas operatives. Palestinian sources and eyewitnesses say the vast majority are civilians, including many children, trying to return to their damaged homes to retrieve items or collect firewood. Meanwhile, the moving yellow line has created a new division between haves and have-nots in Gaza. Those from communities on the Israeli side are twice as vulnerable and doubly dispossessed, not knowing whether they can ever return. Hiba Abu Ajwa, a mother of five from eastern Shujaya, says her family's life has not changed since the Trump peace plan. Everything is the same. We're still displaced. We're still living under hard conditions, says Ms. Abu Ajwa from her tent in Gaza City, while asking her son to fan a cooking fire fed by large melting plastic sheets. I had hoped to return back to my home, even if it's destroyed, to my land, but I'm afraid I'm losing it forever, she says. During a previous Israel-Hamas ceasefire between January and March last year, Ms. Abu Ajwa managed to return to her home in Shujawa and erected a tent over the rubble before a resumption in fighting pushed them out. Now her family home is unreachable. For her, the Israeli-maintained border boundary is reinforcing fear and the displacement of war. What exists today in Gaza is not a ceasefire. You feel as if you do not understand if this is a peace or a war. It's not ending. Life is expensive, and the airstrikes are continuing, she says. When the ceasefire was announced in October, we did not return to our places. We did not return to peace. We're still displaced, she says. We want to look to our children's future, but the drones have not left the sky, she says, pointing to Israeli military drones buzzing overhead. And yet, despite the risk of death, many attempt to return. They go there because that is their homeland. Our souls are there next to our homes and lands, Ms. Abu Ajwa says, of friends and neighbors who have made the risky journey. Her eldest son, Yusuf, tried to return to Shujaiwa, she says, when he reached Salahadin Road, a main artery in central Gaza, west of the Yellow Line, Israeli quadcopters started to fire. He returned to their tent, unable to make the journey. He longed for the area. He wanted to bring some stuff for us, says Ms. Abu Ajwa, who works as a baker for residents in her displacement camp. Gazans are aware of the risks. Whoever goes doesn't come back safe from the shooting, she says. Many took the risk and they died. Why did they go? Because life in displacement drains meaning from us, from the inside. The yellow blocks can appear overnight in a neighborhood. Mr. Abu Shaul, the Beit Hanun lawyer, is one of thousands of Palestinians who have been forced to uproot, pack, and move since the ceasefire began due to the encroaching yellow line. In the beginning of the current ceasefire, his family erected tents in Jabalia. When we started to see the yellow blocks approaching us, then we moved a little bit to the south of Jabalia and ran to the middle of Gaza as we were afraid of being hit by Israeli fire, he says. But, he points out, Israel strikes continue west of the yellow line. I'm afraid that this is the new geography. They mean to destroy Gaza, to choke us. Gaza was already an overpopulated area. Now it's more, as we are forced into smaller areas, he says. We're afraid we'll end up refugees like the 48 and 67, the mass displacement of Palestinians following the 1948 and 1967 wars. But we'll still keep trying to return to our land, says Mr. Abu Salil. Gazans tell the monitor they're eager to see their homes retrieve something from beneath the rubble and walk their streets once more. Ms. Abu Ajwa's son scrolls through photos of Shujaiwa on his phone and asks, when will we go back? He gets no answer. When the line is pushed 100 meters, 200 meters, it's not only land that disappears, but also the idea of returning home, says Ms. Abu Ajwa. Fayez Hussein Awaja is separated from his farm close to the Gaza-Israeli border, where he had 60 acres of olive and citrus groves, land he has barely seen since the start of the Israeli-Hamas war in October 2023. I used to farm near the border. I see the tanks. They're still showing, he says, from his displacement tent in Gaza City. Some people go because they want to see their home, maybe fix something or retrieve something, says Surad Alaja, Fayez's wife. No one is allowed to go back to our area. No one goes. Jesse Jackson's Journey from the South Carolina Protest to Presidential Runs by Ken Macon, Cultural Commentator, February 17, 2026. Back in 2024, I met the Reverend Jesse Jackson on Juneteenth and watched him do something truly remarkable, cast a shadow as a giant, figuratively as more than 40-foot tall and 150-foot wide monument to freedom was being dedicated in Montgomery, Alabama. There was a sea of people who took part in the monument's dedication, and then those souls gravitated towards Mr. Jackson in a manner worthy of his gravitas. Charismatic leadership is a phrase that might be used to describe Mr. Jackson's persona in politics, much like it might have been used to describe Martin Luther King Jr. or Malcolm X. And yet, what defines them and their legacies is not celebrity alone. It's their actions and words, expressed in and out of season, in the spirit of creating a better world. Mr. Jackson died Tuesday morning at age 84. His family confirmed in a statement, which spoke glowingly of him being a servant leader. His unwavering commitment to justice, equality, and human rights helped shape a global movement for freedom and dignity, Mr. Jackson's family wrote. A tireless change agent, he elevated the voices of the voiceless, from his presidential campaigns in the 1980s to mobilizing millions to register to vote, leaving an indelible mark on history. As a South Carolina native, and like the late Chadwick Boseman, connected with South Carolina's upstate, I knew about Mr. Jackson at a young age. More importantly, I was familiar with the protests that activated him and many others, the desegregation of libraries in his native Greenville in 1960. During the Christmas break of 1959, Mr. Jackson came home from the University of Illinois and attempted to secure a book for an assignment, but was rebuffed at a whites-only library. After a pair of initial protests the following March on July 16, 1960, Mr. Jackson and seven high school students would return to that library and perform an effective sit-in before being arrested. A similar occurrence happened in February of 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina, with students at North Carolina A&T, and proved effective against segregated businesses. Mr. Jackson later transferred to North Carolina A&T, where he played football and was elected student body president. By the end of the decade, his personality and politics connected him with Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. In 1966, Mr. Jackson took the reins in Operation Breadbasket, a Chicago-based program focusing on economic empowerment. That project established Mr. Jackson's roots in Chicago and was the genesis for future mobilization efforts, such as the Rainbow Push Coalition. After Dr. King's assassination in 1968, Mr. Jackson was seen as his successor because of their contributions to civil and human rights. While Dr. King's criticisms of Vietnam eventually led to his pro-labor and pro-black campaign in Memphis, Tennessee, Mr. Jackson's criticism of the Ronald Reagan administration led to two bids for the Democratic nomination in 1984 and 1988. When Mr. Jackson didn't win the nomination in either campaign, he crafted populist messaging that would be realized 20 years later with the election of Barack Obama, whose Yes We Can and Hope was similar to his predecessor's exhortation of keep hope alive. And here's an article from the Middle East. Progress but not compromise as latest U.S.-Iran nuclear talks end. By Scott Peterson, staff writer. February 17th, London. A second round of talks between Iran and the United States in Geneva on Tuesday over Tehran's nuclear program yielded agreement on guiding principles, according to Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, but there were few signs of compromise from either side. Mr. Araghchi said, "The path for a deal has started, and that draft proposals will be exchanged before setting a date for the third round." A U.S. official said progress was made, but there are still a lot of details to discuss. The official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, said Iran would provide detailed proposals within 2 weeks to address open gaps in our positions. Yet the talks are taking place in the shadow of recent events that have raised tensions and renewed the prospects of conflict, as both sides voice demands unacceptable to the other. Iran wants to limit talks only to curbing its nuclear program in exchange for lifting American sanctions that would have throttled its economy. President Donald Trump has made clear that he wants Iran's remaining nuclear program dismantled, as well as, in an echo of Israeli demands, limits to the range of Iran's missile arsenal and ending Iran's support for regional militia allies such as Hezbollah. Mr. Trump said last week that regime change in Iran is the best thing that could happen, and that the Islamic Republic would regret not making a deal. But Iran says American terms amount to surrender. Mr. Araghchi, before the Geneva talks, said he brought real ideas to achieve a fair and equitable deal. What is not on the table is submission before threats. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said on Tuesday that his country's missile program is non-negotiable. Possessing deterrent weapons is necessary and obligatory for our nation, Mr. Khamenei said. The Americans illogically say we should not have this type of missile or that range, while this matter concerns the Iranian nation and has nothing to do with them. Iran is still reeling from a lethal crackdown by regime security forces against street protests in January that left more than 7,000 people dead, according to activists. Mr. Trump promised to hit very hard if protesters were killed, and has sought to raise pressure for a deal by amassing a naval armada aimed at Iran, which includes two aircraft carrier battle groups and air assets throughout the region. Mr. Khamenei dismissed the U.S. threat and suggested a severe Iranian response. "They keep saying we have sent an aircraft carrier towards Iran. Fine, an aircraft carrier is certainly a dangerous piece of equipment, but more dangerous than the carrier is the weapon capable of sending it to the bottom of the sea." Over the past 2 years, Iran has seen its power eroded. Israel last June launched a surprise air campaign against Iran that lasted 12 days and saw multiple waves of Iranian missiles fired at Israel in response. U.S. stealth bombers joined the battle to strike Iran's deeply buried nuclear facilities. In Geneva, the U.S. team was led by Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, Mr. Trump's son-in-law. The indirect meeting, at which the American and Iranian delegations sat in separate rooms while Omani officials mediated, lasted less than 2 hours. In contrast, the string of complex negotiations that led to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal with the world powers required 2.5 years of talks. Mr. Trump unilaterally withdrew the United States from that deal in 2018, though Iran had until then adhered to its strict limits. And here's an editorial by the Monitor's View. People power, why the U.S. South is seeing education gains. Studies in 2025 pointed to declining achievement in foundational reading and math skills among American students. But four states in the South are demonstrating that high standards and elevated expectations can raise performance, despite scarce resources. By the Monitor's editorial board, February 17, 2026. In a well-known folktale, young Goldilocks tests out three bears' porridge, too hot, too cold, just right, as well as their chairs and beds. The story delights most children of preschool age, but when these children enter school, according to education experts in the United States, a Goldilocks approach to developing foundational skills does not serve them well. Teaching and grading that aligns content and standards to a just-right fit, rather than challenging students to grow, is a disservice. In the view of University of Illinois Chicago literacy professor Timothy Shanahan, this popular approach to teaching has been holding kids back rather than helping them succeed, he wrote in The Conversation last fall. Students learn more than when taught with more difficult texts. This observation captures renewed focus on U.S. public education, on elevating standards, curricula, and performance. Too many American students are woefully underprepared for college, and last year's National Assessment of Educational Progress, NAEP, showed a continuing decline in test scores in reading and mathematics. But that same report also highlighted bright spots. A handful of southern states that are blazing a trail to higher student achievement, even with limited financial resources. Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Tennessee, previously seen as perennial low achievers, have all made remarkable strides in recent years. Their gains are challenging conventional wisdom about the links between learning gaps, funding, poverty, and racism. About a decade ago, Mississippi was 49th in fourth grade national reading results. Now, when adjusting for socioeconomic and demographics, NAEP ranks it number one in fourth grade reading, as well as in fourth and eighth grade math. Strategies contributing to the southern surge include the tackling of student absenteeism, pre-kindergarten and holiday learning programs, and teacher upskilling. Mississippi changed how it teaches reading and also embraced contentious school accountability policies other states have backed away from, according to a January New York Times report. One of those is the third grade gate, a test that all students must pass to move to the fourth grade. The real concerns this test would be disproportionately impact low-income children. But according to Times commentator Nicholas Kristof, the third grade gate lit a fire under Mississippi. It injected accountability. Principals, teachers, parents, and children themselves were galvanized. In fact, the state's black students, about 47% of the student population, now rank number three, and Hispanic students, 5%, are number one in fourth grade national testing. Alongside academic rigor and support systems, elevated expectations and trust in young learners' innate intelligence, curiosity, and goodness are also key. A blog on the educator-focused website, New Leaders Notes, students know and understand when educators have high expectations for them, and they perform better academically as a result. Having high expectations means we believe all students can learn at exceedingly high levels, it says. This in turn instills the confidence and agency to strive. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Julie Lenny. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sansounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. And here's an article on the Olympics. Now the Olympic pressure is on Mikaela Shiffrin. How can she handle it? By Mark Sappenfield, Senior Global Correspondent. February 17th, Cortina d'Ampezzo, Italy. The last time the Olympic world really saw Mikaela Shiffrin was 2014. It was already clear that that she would be the next big thing. As an 18-year-old in the Sochi Games, she was doing things that 18-year-olds just didn't do, such as become the youngest ever Olympic slalom champion. Nothing has been the same since. In one world, she's become the undisputed greatest skier in history. She's won 108 World Cup races, 22 more than second place Ingemar Sandmark, the Swedish former World Cup alpine ski racer who dominated the moon circuit in the 1970s and 80s. And Miss Shiffrin is not slowing down. This season, she's won 7 of 8 World Cup slaloms, 5 of them, astonishingly, by more than 1 second. In the one she lost, she finished 2nd by 0.14 seconds. Then there's the Olympics. On Wednesday, Miss Shiffrin will ski in the slalom, and the question is, which Mikaela Shiffrin? The difference between the Olympic Mikaela Shiffrin and the Mikaela Shiffrin so conspicuous in the 206 weeks between Olympic Games is massive. Her troubles at the 2022 Games, shortly after her father died, are well documented. Considered a medal hopeful in 5 events, she won no medals, failing to even finish the giant slalom. Slalom, or combined event, which includes a downhill and slalom leg. Here in Cortina, she has finished her 2 races, but slowly by her standards. Her slalom leg in the combined event was the 4th slowest of the 18 racers who finished. Her giant slalom was better, only 0.3 seconds off the podium, but only good for 11th. Here's the problem that faced Ilya Marinin and Miss Shiffrin herself in Beijing. How does the athlete who is unquestionably the greatest in her sport manage the immensity of the great American Olympic hype machine? Mr. Marinin frankly admitted that he had failed to understand the weight of that pressure in his first Olympics before a disastrous performance in the men's free skate. At her 4th Olympics, Miss Shiffrin has a different challenge. With every race, the weight builds. But in speaking with reporters after the giant slalom Sunday, she seemed to offer her own answer. Gold medalist Frederica Bergenmann had come back from a major injury to ski here. The mentality that she has to trust sending it down the hill to give everything, Ms. Shiffrin says. I wish I could explain how impressive that is. Performances by Ms. Bergenmann, as well as those by double gold American speed skater Jordan Stolz and triple gold Swiss alpine skier Franjo van Almen, hold the answer to not-so-secret secret sauce. Ms. Shiffrin knows it too. To win, you must get into that mental space where the skiing is free and the movements instinctive. On the World Cup Tour, Ms. Shiffrin essentially owns that space with a penthouse view. But how does she find it here on this biggest stage of winter sport? For each athlete, the answer is different. And Ms. Shiffrin is clearly doing her best to find it. But she's no longer the 18-year-old up-and-comer who enthused about how much she had learned from watching her opponents. Now everyone is watching her and expecting something more than the World Cup win, but an Olympic moment. The catch, of course, is that Olympic moments are delivered precisely because your athletes approach their performances as something ordinary, or at least routine. For Ms. Brignone, her Olympic moments come from the ability to let go. Her injury in April completely changed her outlook. She went from wondering if she would ever ski again to standing in the stairhouse of her home Olympics, thankful to be there. I think I was coming here to win gold medals. I would go home with more medals. Coming here was already a miracle, she said after the second of her gold medals in the giant slalom. I had everything that I wanted, so I came here just to enjoy it, try my best, and be grateful to have to be here at home. Before Ms. Olympics, Ms. Brignone had 37 World Cup wins and 3 Olympic medals, though no goals. By changing her expectations, she found a new freedom. It was different. I needed to be here without the training that I wanted, the body that I wanted. But the good thing was that I had no pressure. It was already amazing just being here, she added. I just tried to enjoy every single moment of it. That certainly characterizes Mr. Van Armen. The word fun could be emblazoned on his helmet. Asked about equaling the record of 3 Alpine gold medals at Olympic Games, he said, "It seems stupid, but I'm not really interested in what's on the paper. For me, I'm really trying to enjoy the Olympics here, and maybe in a few years it'll be important for me. But for now, it isn't really." After his father's death, Mr. Van Armen nearly quit skiing at 17. It took a GoFundMe campaign to save his career. In the summers, he still works as a professional carpenter. His priorities are just different. Before every run, he tells himself, "Rock and roll and enjoy," according to a profile on his Red Bull page. American Ryan Cochran Siegel, who finished second to Mr. Van Armen in the Super G, said as much. He's such a fun skier to watch and to learn from, too, but also his personality. He just seems like he's having fun every single day, he said. Obviously, he has a lot of hardware around his neck these days, but I feel like that's because he's able to have so much fun, he added. The same could be said of speed skater Mr. Stolz, though in a different way. Fun isn't exactly what leaps to mind. Why, maybe? In that twinkle is the slightest bit of condescension, but in a good way. He absolutely loves being a speed skater, and yes, winning at the Olympics is the crown jewel of his sport and the best way to remind Americans that speed skating does, in fact, exist in those other 206 weeks. But in the end, why freak out over trying to impress a bunch of people who don't follow the sport anyway? He'll prepare, he'll race, and maybe he'll win. But even if he doesn't, he'll have more races in a few weeks, and those will be a blast too. Mr. Stolz admitted to being nervous before his 1,000-meter race. But in the end, he took it back to something he knew. "It's repetition," he said in the post-race press conference. "Winning a 1,000 meters is not something I don't know how to do." After the journalists dispersed, Mr. Stolz and silver medalist Jenny Debu found themselves walking through the arena together, talking shop. Yes, the two most dominant speed skating sprinters in the world were not giving each other death stares or talking trash ahead of their epic matchup in the 500 meters days later. They amble through the empty halls, comparing notes, sharing expectations, and happily discussing the craft. Because to them, clearly, speed skating is fun, even in the Olympics. And here's a Christian Science perspective. Are some people evil? Turning to God enables us to glimpse the inherent goodness of God's children. By Jenny Sawyer, February 17th. "I know there are good people in the world," the high school student told me, It's just that now I know there are evil people too. Yes, his regular diet of TikTok content showcasing tyranny and brutality from every corner of the world had helped forge this perception. But it wasn't just that, he said. All he had to do was look around his community to see the same things playing out on a smaller scale. Maybe you felt the same way about this good-evil divide. It's not like the evidence isn't right before our eyes. But even in the conversation with this student, there was something that offered a glimmer of hope. His tone told me that some part of him wanted to be proven wrong. He wanted to have faith that there's at least some good in every single one of us. That's a role Christian Science has played in my life when I've been wrestling with tough questions. By turning me towards God, it's helped prove that my own take on things isn't necessarily accurate. This isn't always easy to accept. And yet, when I do accept this divine perspective, good turns out to be the real deal, the only power. Yes, even the people who before may have seemed like bullies, tyrants, and enemies. That's what I was thinking about during this conversation about evil people. I was thinking of a time when a friend who's a high school teacher asked me to pray because there was a potentially dangerous situation. A group of students seemed on the brink of taking control of the class. She was scared, and honestly, after hearing her story, so was I. In the past, whenever I felt afraid or helpless, the best, most healing solutions have always come when I've asked God to show me what He knows, what's real. One of the names the Bible gives to God is truth, and I've always loved this name because it tells me that if I want the actual truth and not just my own or someone else's perspective, God, truth itself, is the only place to get it. Likewise, God is love. This was especially comforting in this situation because love felt like an answer to danger, fear, and potential violence. I turned to God, to love and truth, with my whole heart and asked for help. I wanted to see beyond the appearance of destructive people or evil intentions and know more about what was really going on. What was God causing, seeing, and knowing about these students? Immediately, this thought, and actually it was deeper than a thought, because it came as a feeling in my heart, too, bubbled up. They want to be good. I knew in a way that was undeniable that this was true. Good feels like home. It's the most natural thing to each of us. The truth north, the true north to which our internal compass naturally swings. This has to be the case because we come from God, who is pure good. Good can create and cause only good. Good must flow out from being from good the way light has to flow out from the sun, simply because of the nature of its source. I could see how my previous perspective, compelling though it had seemed, couldn't be correct. Since these teens weren't self-determining individuals who could choose between being good and being bad, each of them was a son or daughter of God and was only good, just like their father and mother. And this proved to be true. The situation in my friend's classroom turned around immediately. The bullying, threats, and power struggle stopped. One student even apologized. Could this have happened if there really were evil people? To state the obvious, no. And even now, with all that's going on in the world, I can continue to rest solidly on the same truth that brought peace to my friend's classroom. Everyone wants to be good, because in reality, everyone is good. And when it doesn't seem like it, that's when we can be a witness, the prayers, the spiritual seers that our communities and the world needs. Whether we see something on our own street corner or on a video from a country thousands of miles away, we can play a part in standing for and drawing out good. We can ask God to show us the goodness inherent in each of us and allow our trust in good to expand until we truly know that that's all there is and that's who we really are. not evil, good, all of us. This was adapted from an article published in the Christian Science Sentinel's Teen Connect section, February 2nd, 2026. And now I run out of today's articles, I'll take one from earlier this last week. From the Explainer, What is the Save America Act and How Could It Change U.S. Voting? By Caitlin Babcock, staff writer. Updated February 12, 2026. Republicans in Congress are pushing to pass a bill that would impose new requirements on people registering to vote, and it could affect people updating their registrations. The House of Representatives voted Wednesday to approve the Save America Act, which would require people to show proof of citizenship to register to vote in federal elections and a government-issued photo ID to cast a ballot. The requirements are widely popular among Americans, but are strongly opposed by Democrats, who say they would prevent millions from voting. The bill has been a priority of Republicans for years. They say it's necessary to stop non-citizens from registering and voting. Something data shows does occur, but is rare enough not to influence election outcomes. The latest iteration comes at a time when the Trump administration, which supports the bill, has criticized the integrity of Americans' elections ahead of this year's congressional midterms. President Donald Trump has made similar criticisms ahead of other presidential elections. On January 28th, the FBI moved to seize cast ballots and other 2020 voting records from an election center in Fulton County, Georgia. In recent months, the Justice Department has demanded complete voter registration lists from almost every state. Roughly two dozen states have rejected this request. Many states prohibit the disclosure of voting data without a court order. On Sunday, Mr. Trump called on Republicans in Congress to fight for the Save America Act. Despite his claims of a stolen election, no evidence of fraud has surfaced that would call into question the results of the 2020 election, which Mr. Trump lost to Joe Biden. The bill is the latest version of the Save America Act, properly known as the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, which passed the House in April, but stalled in the Senate. Under the bill, most people would need a passport or birth certificate to register to vote. Additional options include military IDs and records of service, as well as enhanced driver's licenses offered in a handful of states. People who submit voter registration forms by mail would still need to present proof of citizenship in person. The bill also requires people to present a photo ID to cast their ballot. 36 states have some form of voter ID law, but the Save America Act would impose stricter provisions than most of those laws, according to experts. People could still vote by absentee ballot in federal elections if they attached a copy of an acceptable photo ID to their ballot requests and submission forms. Most Americans approve of the bill's core provisions. In 2024 Gallup poll, 84% of respondents supported requiring voters to present a photo ID at their voting places, and 83% supported requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote. Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, says voters' ID laws tend to make little impact. Studies show they have neither greatly reduced fraud nor caused wide-scale disenfranchisement. But Mr. Olson says requiring people to show documents proving they are citizens when registering to vote puts a greater burden on potential voters and could have unintended consequences. For example, election workers could face criminal penalties under the proposed law if they register someone who fails to present documentary proof of citizenship. The law also directs states to devise a way to verify people's citizenship if they can't access the required documents. Because that process could create vagaries and complications for elected workers, it might be easier and less risky to just say no. The practical effect is to install a big old bias towards not accepting documents, says Mr. Olson. What is the path forward in Congress? In January, Republican Representatives Anna Paulina Luna of Florida and Tim Burchett of Tennessee threatened to vote against passing a government funding package unless the Save America Act was attached. Both backed down after pressure from the White House. If it passes the House this week, the bill is expected to stall in the Senate, where it would need to at least 7 Democratic votes to break a filibuster. Ms. Luna plans to try to attach the measure to a must-pass intelligence funding bill in April. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York called the provision dead on arrival. Democrats say the bill is unnecessary, given that it is already illegal and rare for non-citizens to vote in federal elections, according to organizations including the Brennan Center and the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Democrats also worry it will disenfranchise voters who can't access documents and that prove citizenship. A 2024 Brennan Center survey found 9% of Americans of voting age either did not possess documents to prove their citizenship or didn't have them readily available. Experts say those most likely to be affected include conservative would-be voters who are less likely than Democrats to hold a passport. Conservative women are also more likely to change their last names when they marry, creating complications when using a birth certificate as identification. The bill's opponents also say it's a requirement to present proof of citizenship in person could disproportionately affect certain groups. For example, says Greta Bitkovics, the Director of Democracy at the Center for American Progress, would-be voters in rural states might have to drive long distances simply to register to vote. She worries it would leave staffers in many election offices completely overwhelmed. Republicans such as Ms. Luna say the bill is needed to protect the rights of American voters. Both parties do have a vested interest in making sure that all eligible citizens and only eligible citizens can register and vote in federal elections, says Rachel Oray, director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Elections Project. It's an integrity measure. It's also a voter protection measure. That said, Oray worries the Save America Act could create new barriers for eligible voters. They cite a study that found that a 3-year proof of citizenship mandate in Kansas barred more than 35,000 people from the state's rolls. President Trump has repeatedly claimed without evidence that widespread voter fraud caused his loss in 2020. Last March, he signed an executive order requiring documentary proof of citizenship for voting registration, but large portions of that order have since been blocked by federal judges after multiple states and voting rights groups sued. In an interview last week, Mr. Trump accused 15 unnamed states of being crooked and urged Republicans in Congress to take over voting procedures in those states and nationalize the voting. He also said last week that if states can't win elections, Congress should step in. No evidence has emerged to back his claims about states' abilities to run fair elections. Under the Constitution, states are primarily responsible for governing elections. Some experts on election integrity are voicing concerns that the president is laying the groundwork for efforts to pressure state election systems in his own party's advantage this fall, or to challenge some midterm outcomes that don't go Republicans' way. If anybody who doubted that this administration is laying the foundation to interfere in elections, the deluge of activity over the last 2 weeks should lay those doubts to rest. Wendy Weiser, Vice President for Democracy at the Brennan Center for Justice, told Fox on Monday. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt has said the president's comments referred to his desire for Congress to pass the Save America Act. The president never referenced the bill, which does not contain specific language about nationalizing elections. Editor's note, this story, originally published February 10th, has been updated to reflect the House vote on February 11th, and that the bill no longer requires people to show proof of citizenship to vote. And here's a poem called Praying with the News. It's possible to rise above distress and anger to actively pray for our communities, and this poem expresses that, by Carol Dismore. Reading news reports this morning, suddenly with no forewarning, something struck my thought to drag it down. Caught off balance, falling, reeling, down the vortex went my feeling, magnetism pulling, pulling down. Stop, I tell myself with vigor, love is infinitely bigger, lifting me instead of pulling down. Love denies what I am seeing, reaffirms the truth of being. God is everywhere, there is no down. Waking up, no pun intended, all that downward pull is ended. Nothing can disturb my thought today. Praying now for those affected, every trace of sin rejected, praising God, I bear a song away. Philip Doddridge, Christian Science Hymnal, number 124. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Joanne Leone, a volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.